From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the program, a researcher taps the members of a local-based organization to learn more about the genetics of obesity.
We use the differences in the sequence of the DNA and associate that with the differences in your trait, such as obesity.
Then we explore how swearing has evolved since the days of ancient Rome, and we'll catch up with the Alchemist Theater and their new production of King Lear. Plus, we'll take a short road trip to 11th and Kilbourne to visit the Chudnow Museum of yesteryear.
We believe in the immersion exhibit, much like the streets of old Milwaukee. You can walk into the store, you can walk into the location and see what's on display rather than just look through a window.
Lake Effect comes your way next, after the news. Welcome to Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. It is great to have your company this morning. A partnership between a Medical College of Wisconsin research team and a Milwaukee-based patient advocacy group is reporting significant results in learning more about the ties between genes and obesity. Dr. Sherry Zhang is an instructor in the Human and Molecular Genetics Center at the Medical College of Wisconsin, and she's worked with the national organization called TOPS, Take Off Pounds Sensibly. Barbara Cady is president of the group. They recently joined Lake Effect's Mitch Teich, and Zhang elaborated on the link between genetics and obesity.
As you know, people's genomes are very different. If I compare mine with yours, we're going to find probably 3 million basis, which is the building block of the genome, that many differences between you and me. And you can imagine in a population of 1,000 people, and that will be just greatly increased in the differences. So we use the differences in the sequence of the DNA and associate that with the differences in your trait, such as obesity and related traits. So from there, we'll be able to pinpoint the genes that link your DNA differences with your traits differences.
Well, and so how strong do you see this connection at this stage?
We have statistically significant associations between the genes we identified and our obesity traits. So a lot of downstream work has to be done to confirm the functionality of those genes. But the evidence we saw was pretty strong.
Is this an aha moment, if you will? We found these two genes, and now we think we're really onto something.
We are on something, especially because this work has been built on years of collaboration between MCW and TOPS Club. And over the past 3 decades, a significant progress has been made to finer narrowing down to the regions that harbor certain genes. And in this work we published recently in Obesity Journal, we were be able to, for the first time, pinpoint which particular genes are playing a role. Of course, their obesity is a complex disease. That means it's being influenced by multiple factors. And the current thinking is it's determined by the gene, the environment, and the interaction between the two.
That was my next question, is what we know about the relationship between environmental factors and these two particular genes.
That we don't know, and I have a special interest of myself in looking into that. There's something, it's called epigenetics, that link the genes with the environment. So that's definitely next thing to look at.
Well, and Barb Cady, this is maybe an obvious question, but the TOPS Club is not a research-specific club. It is more, I guess, patient-centered, if you will. Why was it important for you to be involved in the research arm of work on obesity?
Well, we are a nonprofit organization, and it's one of the key facets of the organization. We are member-based, member-driven, member-determined in our mission, and the mission of the people who suffer from this disease, from obesity, is to at some day find a cure, and if not a cure, at least an effective method of control that does no harm. Because I'm sure you're aware that through the years there have been many, many modalities offered, some of which do critical harm to individuals through time. And our mission is to try to find a healthy way of living for all of us that deal with this disease on a daily basis.
Now, I gather at the heart of your work is something called metabolic syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
Where does that come in? What is metabolic syndrome and how does your work have implications for it?
Sure. So metabolic syndrome is a specialized form of obesity. So it started with increased body composition changes. And the definition of metabolic syndrome has been evolved over the years. But the most commonly accepted definition will be including increased abdominal fat distribution and insulin resistance and lipids abnormalities and some increased profile or abnormal profile of cytokines or adipokines, which is stuff you secreted from your adipocytes and other cells. It is very common. And once you have those manifestations of those traits of metabolic syndrome, your risk for developing cardiovascular diseases and type 2 diabetes will be greatly increased.
Well, and so what do we know about the genetics of metabolic syndrome? People say all the time, well, you know, my family is big boned or, you know, my grandfather always had a pot belly, so will you or so will I. Is the science now supporting these kinds of ancestral associations?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a way we can assess the heritable part, which is you can pass it down from your grandfather to your father and to you. And that portion of your traits differences is genetically determined. That's how we define it.
What does it say, though, about the inevitability of developing these traits? Is there I would imagine this is something that TOPS is especially interested in. What does it say about the implications for doing something about it?
We could help to early detect the mutations you have in your genes that inherited from your ancestors. And from there, you could have a plan to change your diet or lifestyles down the road. So, you know, there's a very non-invasive intervention you could do, you know, increase your calcium intake if, you know, some enzymes are being expressed low, which will lead to certain cardiovascular diseases. I'm just making that example. But things like that. So early detection, I'm really a believer of early detection and personalized medicine. So if you can know them early, and you can definitely do something in your life.
Barb Katie, does this make for a more, I don't know, complicated dynamic when it comes to talking about weight loss? I would imagine on one hand, it is very comforting to know if you are someone who is dealing with obesity issues that perhaps that, you know, there was a genetic component to this. This was not just about eating too much or not exercising enough. But at the same time, genes are somewhat harder to work against than cheeseburgers.
Well, we all have certain genetic heritage, and your genes do not necessarily mandate. They can predispose, but if you're aware of what your genetic history is, then you can make modification. And one of the nicest things of this association with the medical college that directly applies to our members and how we cope is they've been very encouraging about the impact of small changes through time, making significant differences in all of the profiles associated with metabolic syndrome.
Small changes like?
Walking a little bit more, not engaging in a full impact course of aerobics when you're 100 pounds overweight, eating more healthily, not cutting out everything, but eating more healthily, trying to lose 10% of the excess weight as opposed to saying you must lose it all to get healthy. They really have been very strong in their support of us that as you make progress, things improve. You don't have to wait until you're at ideal goal weight for the impact to be felt and experienced and your quality of life to improve.
This is an incremental approach, you're saying?
Yes. Absolutely.
Well, and do you think I get a sense from this interview and from others I've done in the past, have we been too quick to oversimplify the obesity dynamic in the past?
That's an interesting mm-hmm. question. It's a very interesting question. Eating less and moving more definitely are the recommended beginning steps that you take. they're not necessarily enough all by themselves. You have to take into account so many other factors. Often, your own body works against you. And if you've had a history of losing and regaining weight, everything changes somewhat because your metabolic rate actually gets somewhat suppressed as you try to struggle with controlling this disease through time. So what was true for you at the beginning is no longer true. You're actually changed. Your body fat distribution has altered. The rate at which you burn, what you eat has changed. You're actually fatter now than when you began, even though your same weight may be the...
Well, Sherry Zhang and Barb Cady, thank you both so much.
Thank you for having
me. Oh, it's our pleasure. Thank you.
Dr. Sherry Zhang is an instructor in the Human and Molecular Genetics Center at the Medical College of Wisconsin. Barb Cady is president of the national organization called TOPS, Take Off Pounds Sensibly, which is based in Milwaukee. The organization and the college work together on recent research into the genetics of obesity, which will be published in an upcoming edition of the journal Obesity. Zhang is presenting their findings at the TOPS annual meeting in Calgary, Alberta, this week. Coming up next, we'll talk with the author of a book whose name we have to censor per FCC regulations. A Brief History of Swearing comes your way next on Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. It was a rough day for communication at Lake Effect yesterday. Our email and online calendar programs were working poorly at best. It was a situation that resulted in one, maybe two, or maybe 100 expletives as we'd all try to get our work done. You're probably familiar with some of those words, but what would you have said in Victorian England or in ancient Rome had our email suddenly stopped working? Well, aside from what do you mean by email? Milwaukee native Melissa Moore could tell us. Moore, who holds a doctorate in Renaissance literature, is the author of a new book, the name of which would cause us to run afoul of FCC regulations. We'll refer to it euphemistically as Holy S-Word, A Brief History of Swearing. Moore tells Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke why, of all the subsets of language, she believes swearing is worth studying.
Well, swear words and phrases are important because they affect people very differently than other words do. They have really different physiological effects. So when you swear, your heart rate increases. The person who you're swearing at, their heart rate increases. Swearing relieves pain. It helps relieve emotions. If you're feeling particularly angry or if you're feeling particularly joyful, you know, the best word you can use is a swear word.
Well, and the physiological stuff was among the most unexpected of the points that you make in this book. I mean, there are researchers that you write about that have studied that not only does it just seem like a catharsis or you have this physiological response, but there are studies that show people are less prone to pain if they're swearing?
Yeah, it really is cathartic, right? There's a study that you can hold your hand longer in a bucket of ice cold water if you're swearing than if you're saying a neutral word like shoot. And so, yeah, really it helps with pain relief. And I think this is because it's connected to emotional centers in our brain. Swear words are stored and processed differently in the brain. So they have a lot more to do with what you might call the limbic system that controls emotion and parts of our nervous system that aren't under conscious control.
Well, right. You relate this anecdote right at the beginning of the book about, was it your grandmother?
Yeah, my grandmother who had Alzheimer's and who could no longer construct a meaningful sentence, but she could still swear. And that was the last word she said to me was a swear word.
Well, okay, so let me get to the other point here. Is it oversimplifying things to say that how we swear defines what we find important or sacred and not even necessarily in the religious sense?
I don't think it's an oversimplification. I mean, I think that's true. Maybe it's an oversimplification, but it definitely is basically true in that people swear about what they care about, I guess you would say. And historically, that's changed in some interesting ways. So, for instance, in the Middle Ages, there were many more religious taboos. And so the really worst words you could say to someone were by God's bones. They were religious oaths based on God and Jesus. And then, you know, in the Victorian era, when people got very prudish and interested in decorum, I guess you might call it, then the sexual and excremental obscenities that we have now started to become much more powerful. And then today you've got racial obscenities becoming the really worst words. And I think that, you know, reflects our cultural obsessions, I guess you might say.
Well, so take us through some of this history. I mean, you start with ancient Rome. What forms did these early swearing examples take as far back as you could go?
The ancient Rome stuff I thought was very, very interesting. The swearing was based on sexual taboos, but just very different sexual taboos. And I guess I don't want to say too much about it because it gets pretty – that actually is pretty obscene. But just that they didn't divide people into the same groups that we do. They divided people into what you might call active and passive. And what was stigmatized in the culture was passivity. And so all their swear words reflect disdain for people who, I guess, received sexual advances.
So then how did or why did swearing evolve to these other things, things like bodily functions and sex?
Well, so I think once you leave ancient Rome, you get the Bible and the first religious swearing. You know, there's a lot in the Bible about how you should swear, how you shouldn't swear. And in the Middle Ages, they took a lot of those rules extremely seriously. And that's one of the reasons the religious oaths were so powerful then. The sort of sexual words were not powerful in the Middle Ages because they just had a very different conception of privacy, that they basically didn't have privacy. And they did in public a lot of the things that we do privately and are ashamed of. And once you're doing them in public, like excreting and having sex, and the, you know, if you're not doing it privately, it's very open. You don't have the same sense of shame about it, and therefore you don't need taboo words for it.
Well, and you make a really interesting point here because you have just described what some of these – what we think of as swear words represent. But in almost every case, there is a clinical word that you can substitute for a swear word. And so then why are swear words necessary? Why don't we think of words like excrement as taboo?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, cool. It is very interesting why, because we seem to need these words that release our emotions. Right. Yes, there are all kinds of registers for talking about excrement. You can use poop, you can use excrement, you know, you can use a swear word, you know, and we seem to need all these different levels, but the swear words really do something that other words can't.
Do you find any difference? Is there a difference between swearing in print and swearing out loud? I'm not sure I get it exactly, but I feel as I was reading this book that I would have been more squeamish if I had been listening to it than if I had been reading it.
Yeah, that has definitely been my experience. that even people who are very interested in swearing, if you get talking about it, people do get offended. I mean, the power of these words has been demonstrated to me over and over. It's much easier, and it was easier to write about than it is to swear. You know, I don't really swear usually, but I had no problem writing those words over and over.
Let me ask you this. What were the biggest surprises you found as you studied this? And really, how much academic research is out there in terms of understanding where swearing has been and where it is today?
There have been some really good books about contemporary swearing. You know, Randall Kennedy's – I can't even say the title of his book on the air, but it's, you know, the N-word. And there have been another one called Expletive Deleted. But this is, I think, the first history, sort of more popular history. It's, you know, it was written for a general audience. There has been one other academic history of swearing. So it was actually quite hard to research. I'd had to look at lots and lots of genres of texts. And, you know, in many cases, especially in the Victorian era – the words are not recorded, even though people were using them. The evidence is very sparse. So it was interesting to try and reconstruct that.
Some of the Victorian stuff is, I think we would think of it as pretty remarkable, just the use of the word leg and the use of the word trousers.
Yes. That those things were shocking because the human body was so taboo that, you know, yeah, you couldn't say trousers because that might lead you to remember that people had bodies and goodness gracious, where you could go from there.
You write that you yourself were most disturbed by writing about and thinking or talking about racially motivated swearing. Why did you find that was?
I think that is the biggest taboo now, and that I guess I've internalized that taboo. But the F word for people of my generation, I'm 40, I think that's more of a joke. You know, you can – I mean, it's still a bad word, but you can joke about it. You can use it with your friends, but racial slurs are so taboo. Whereas I think for younger people, I think it changes with age. For younger people, they may be slightly less taboo. For older people, you know, even the title of my book can be really offensive.
Well, and what about the notion that the more a swear word is used, the less effective it is? You know, we think back on George Carlin's famous routine about the seven words you can never say on television. And, of course, you can say some of those words on television now. Are we always in need of inventing new swear words that are potentially more offensive than the ones that have been rendered obsolete?
I think that is true. I think we are always inventing new ones, and sometimes it takes a long time. Like in the Middle Ages, it was about 1,000 years where "by God's bones" was the phrase you'd use to insult someone or to relieve pain. And racial slurs, for example, it's only since about the 30s and 40s that they've started to really become taboo. So I think that the time it takes to replace them can differ. But yeah, I think we do need those words. They are those really powerful, emotionally cathartic words, and so that we'll always have a category.
You're right that there are some people that would contend that swearing is or can be lazy or a poor substitute for a more creative use of language. Where do you come down on that argument?
I mean, I think, you know, obviously it can be the case that if someone, you know, is just swearing constantly, I suppose it's maybe because they're having trouble figuring out what they really want to say. But I think for the most part, that's not true. I mean, people have done studies about who swears the most, and it's not, at least according to these studies, it's not, quote unquote, uneducated people. It's people in the working classes, but it's also people in the what you might call the upper classes. And people who tend not to swear are people in the middle class because they're sort of worried about appearing lower class. And so I don't think it is the sign of a lazy mind.
Are there swears that you came across in researching this book that maybe you wish would come back into vogue? Do you find yourself saying "by God's bones" when you hit yourself with a hammer?
No, I don't. I guess I find myself – because I've got two kids, and so sometimes I find myself sort of swearing in a different language or, you know. "By God's bones" is a good one. I do like that one. But there are lots of good words that have fallen out. But since they're medieval, they weren't actually swear words. But there are lots of good words for body parts and actions that have gone out of use, like "sard" and "swive," which were the F word, equivalent of the F word. Tars is an old word for penis that I think we should bring back. So there are some words like that.
How did you explain this project to your kids?
Well, I think that my kids have now decided that swearing is uncool. Given that their mommy was working on it, they just have lost interest in it. So I didn't actually have to do that much explaining it. Once I explained it, they were like, "Oh, we don't want anything to do with that."
Well, it is a unique specialty to have. And Melissa Moore, thank you so much for sharing some perspective on this with us.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Milwaukee native Melissa Moore's new book is called Holy S-Word, A Brief History of Swearing, published by Oxford University Press. She spoke with Mitch Tyke, and you can hear a slightly off-color anecdote she related about kids and swearing at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Shakespeare was no stranger to swearing, and in fact, he invented quite a few creative expressions, even in tragedies like King Lear. We'll talk with the director and the actor playing Lear in the Alchemist Theater's new production when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. It's Lake Effect on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for joining us. Shakespeare in the summer. There's just something especially inviting about seeing some of the greatest plays in the English canon during the warm days of July. As You Like It is on view at Caddish Park, and across town in Bayview, the Alchemist Theater just opened their production of King Lear, Shakespeare's timeless story of parental love, filial duty, age, power and powerlessness, and madness. Joining me in the studio now are Bo Johnson, who is playing King Lear, and Lita Hoffman, who is the director of the production. Welcome both of you to Lake Effect. It's a pleasure to have you both here.
Good to be here.
Thanks.
So tell me about this production, and one of the greatest in the entire English play canon.
Yeah, a lot of people love the play. A lot of friends of mine that have been in theater all their lives and really think that Lear is their absolute favorite Shakespeare, which I found out after I was cast. And they were all like, "Oh, you get to do that.
You get to do him." Yeah. Had you not aspired to do this role before? I mean, it seems like it's one of the greatest male roles written.
Well, I think any male actor, if they're given the opportunity, they in the back of their minds, they always think, well, what are the roles that I would really like to play before I pass away? Lear certainly is on the list. you know, and then each one of us has other personal favorites. Elwood P. Dowd, I'd love to play someday. Actually, though, to be honest, I always had more of a sight on Prospero because I really loved The Tempest and always thought, well, that would be a great role to play. And you know, Lear was kind of further down the list. But then last year when Aaron Kopek, the owner of Alchemist, and Libby Amato and Anna Figelstaller, I'm always afraid I pronounce her last name wrong, when they wanted to produce Lear and approached me about playing it, of course, I was like, Yeah.
How can you say no?
Right.
Well, Lita, for you directing this, is the first time you've directed Lear?
Yes, it's the first time I've directed Lear. And in fact, it's the first time I've directed a full-length Shakespeare.
So there's a challenge right there.
Yes. You know, so I've watched lots of other directors as their assistant directing Shakespeare and loved Shakespeare my entire life and seen Lear numerous times. But this is the first time I've really dug my teeth into it. And yeah, I was just given a gift of an incredible cast and design team who I feel have really shaped this world and been able to talk to me about the way this world works and how everyone fits inside of it so that we're all telling the same story. This is a very particular production of Lear. You know, every production is different. And we've really, I think, built on the strengths of the intimate setting of the Alchemist Theater.
Yeah, this huge cast, because it's a large cast. Mm-hmm. It's an epic story, and you're on a very small, intimate stage. What kinds of adaptations did you have to do as a director to make it work?
Well, making sure the actors know that they're in an intimate space. I mean, Beau is creating this man who descends into madness, and some people are only 4 feet from him as it's happening, which I think is a pretty special experience to get to do that. Most often you see King Lear and, you know, he's way off in the distance and it seems something distant. This is a very human thing that's happening in this story. So that's part of the way that the actors are telling this story. And as well, I've cut the script, so it's only about 130 minutes.
That's quite a bit.
Yeah. You know, it's the summer and we're inside in a 60-seat theater. And I think it should move along. It's a, you know, it's a entertaining, I guess, is the right word. It's a tragedy. It goes to the depths of human existence and Shakespeare gets there. And I think that when you take his words and you just really trim down and get to the essence of the story, that people have responded really well to the way that it's moving.
And how about you, Beau? As Lear, do you find that the story moves in this kind of I don't want to say truncated, but it's certainly edited.
It's very edited. There's probably, I would say, a full-length Lear is probably an hour longer than this show. So there's an hour of material lost. I think there is poetry that's lost that is a shame not to be able to hear. But at the same time, the story itself, what's important about the story, what it is that motivated each of the characters to do what they've decided to do is all there. And people, a lot of people these days, and especially those people who are being first introduced to Shakespeare, they want to get the story first. And I think we do a great job of doing that. And then if they enjoy this show, then hopefully they'll look for a Lear like at APT or one of the other very good, you know, Wisconsin theater companies where they'll hear the poetry that we have cut out this time. Next time they'll go, it'll be a lot longer, but they know what they're getting into. And then they'll go, oh, that little piece of verse is really cool too. I don't remember hearing that. Oh, it's because they didn't.
But I'm assuming the important poetry like Your Madness on the Heath in the moor.
Oh, yes.
That's
rage,
all there.
Yeah. Blow winds and crack your cheeks. That's all there. Sharper than a serpent's tooth is all there.
Yeah, all those lines that people love. I mean, a lot of the cutting also came down to cutting the minor characters. So in this production, no one plays more than one character. So normally in Shakespeare, spear carrier number two and messenger number four, you know, all the same person. And in this story, even in the smaller roles, you still get to see somebody travel through the entire story as a character that you know and you're interested in. And well, there are all sorts of stories about how is this play doubled. A lot of people believe that perhaps Cordelia and the Fool were played by the same actor. And so we thought about that in the casting process. And then David Flores walked through the door and did this wonderful reading of the Fool. And I went, no, I think that in this production, what's important is the connection between those two people. But they still stand alone as their own characters and have sort of their own purpose in this story.
And of course, one of the great stories of Lear is that relationship that he has with Cordelia, his youngest daughter, his favorite, whom he disowns, whom he rejects, but then comes deeply to regret that. Mm-hmm. For you, exploring that, how did you find your way into it? That's tough stuff.
It really is. And what's especially difficult with Lear is that a lot of the choices that are made early in the play come without any explanation. There is no exposition prior to him walking on and saying, I'm dividing the kingdom between these three daughters, which everyone else on stage knows is a foolish idea. But there's no reason – there's no scene prior to that scene that gives you any indication of what made Lear think that. And then also these sudden fits of temper that he has early in the play where Cordelia doesn't really say anything that's unfair. What she says clearly is, I really do love you, but pulling for it like this is – you're just being silly. So what she's being is just really honest with him in a way that's really loving. I mean in a way where she's just saying – you know I love you. Don't ask me to do this because that's beneath you. So what we really explored with this particular production and to what extent it's coming across, I don't know, but it meant a lot to us is that Lear – and again, there's no scene. You don't have any explanation of it. Just it's just what we're using as motivations to play certain choices. And that is that Lear is already in the midst of early onset dementia. And that he to some extent realizes it, that he knows that it's coming. And so he's made this decision because it's what he thinks he needs to do in order to guarantee himself nursing homes where he thinks they will be. And then when one of those potential nursing homes says, you're being really silly right now, the dementia takes over and he loses it like that. And that is – I mean it's kind of a modern – take. You know, it used to just be referred to as madness, the Mad King. But we know so much more now about Alzheimer's and dementia and the kind of temper that can come at unexplained moments and suddenly losing all touch with reality and being in this place where someone that you know, that person that's afflicted, someone that they love very much suddenly becomes unrecognizable to them and is in a heartbeat the enemy. And so that's a lot of what we kind of looked at.
Mm-hmm. And you can also take those ideas of what it means to be dealing with an aging parent and look at the relationships that he has with his three daughters through that. So, you know, if you use the metaphor of he wants nursing homes from his children, places where he can go in his old age, then you also think about the daughters' perspectives of what happens when they're dementia-ridden parent comes to live with them. And, you know, we all know how difficult that can be, and that I think relates to people's lives in lots of ways. And so these sisters can often be played as evil people. I mean, and what they do by the end of the play, I think you could use that word to describe it. But it comes from a place that we all know and understand, which is, you know, this aging man and 100 of his followers have come to live with them that day, and that maybe that's not going so well.
I was going to say, you know, no matter how big your castle is, that's a lot of people to absorb. And not only an aging man and his 100 followers, but a very demanding aging man. I mean, Lear is nothing if not the king.
Well, he's never been in a world where people don't do whatever he says.
Right.
He walks on in that first scene and says, where's my dinner? And where's my fool? And people don't respond, and he doesn't know what to make of this new world he's appeared in.
He isn't prepared to spend any part of his life not being the king. And it is at the point actually where he realizes that not only has he made some big mistakes, but he isn't the king and he isn't really even the man that he was in terms of physical ability. Well, physically he's still pretty okay, but his mental abilities at the point where he really realizes that not only are they gone, but he used them poorly. There comes a point in the play where he realizes he wasn't really a very good king even when he was powerful and aware. And that's when he just finally loses everything. That's when everything lets go. And he actually becomes a gentler person for it because he's not trying to maintain anything anymore.
I was going to ask you how you saw the end of Lear, where you wanted him to be in that last scene where he has lost everything and he realizes the mistakes that he's made even amongst the madness?
In a word, I'd say humbled. I think that's – for me, that's the arc of this character in my playing goes from being selfish and still being somewhat power-impressed and power-loving, being somewhat controlling, trying to control his daughters into, you know, taking care of him when he knows that things are starting to fail. And then when he finally really does fail, realizing that largely it's due to his own mistakes and he gains a real humility from it. So he ends the play, I think, with humility, and that's important.
And what about your journey as the actor doing him?
The same journey as any role that I take on. You know, first of all, just really getting to know the words and making sure that I can remember them and speak them clearly. I spend a lot of time in advance of rehearsals working on memorization. It's really nice to memorize when you're physically active, I find. So I take long walks from my house, which is up in the Concordia College, old Concordia College neighborhood. I would walk from there to the art museum where I have a membership. There's one particular painting in the Fauvist Gallery of an old man with a big gray beard and sort of a reddish face. And I would sit on the bench in front of that painting and memorize lines for an hour or so. And the art museum guards would stare at me and wonder what was wrong with me. And then I would walk back home and memorize on the way back home. And then once we were in rehearsals, it was, you know, it's theater is a collaborative experience. So it was really all about not just my process, but what Lita wanted to try on different days. And let's look at it from this angle and let's look at it from that angle. So we explored it in a lot of different ways, which was a great part of the process. And then more than anything, just relishing the words because they are great words.
Yeah. I imagine they fill the mouth so beautifully.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
Lita and Bo, thank you so much for stopping by today and best of luck with the rest of the production.
Thanks.
Bo Johnson plays the title role in the Alchemist Theater's production of King Lear. Lita Hoffman directed the play. King Lear runs through July 27th, and there is more information about how you find tickets at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. We'll take one last break, and then we'll take a road trip to Milwaukee's Chudnow Museum of yesteryear, so stay tuned. Lake Effect continues in just a moment on WUWM. We're back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Wisconsin has its share of wonderful museums that tell the stories of the past, from the Milwaukee Public Museum to the Wisconsin Civil War Museum. But there is one museum where you can literally walk through Milwaukee's history. The Chudnow Museum of Yesteryear is only a year old itself, but presents Milwaukee as it was in the interwar period and focuses on the material culture of the 1920s, 30s, and 40s. Located in a converted house at 11th and Kilbourne, the museum's rooms become the literal locales that show a city in transition. And each one is filled to the brim with historic tools, bottles, posters, and other seeming ephemera that were painstakingly collected and preserved by one Milwaukee man. Director Steve Daly gives Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce a tour and explains the museum's origins.
This is the lifelong collection of one man, Abram M. Chudnow, and he was a local businessman who took it upon himself to collect Americana, basically, a social material culture of society. He collected all these different artifacts and objects that kind of document American culture. Kind of shows the consumerism, the rise of industrialization and the population during that time period.
And with the rise of that consumerism, there seems to be an increase in maybe that throwaway culture that Mr. Chudnow was kind of trying to preserve.
Yeah, for whatever reason, he decided early on to save the things that most of us would have put in the garbage a long time ago, like empty candy wrappers and cardboard boxes and tin cans. He saved them. And some of them he saved with contents still in them, and some of them luckily are empty, so we've had to discard some of the petrified contents out of some of the boxes or cans, but for the most part, most of them are empty.
Well, Steve, where are we standing right now?
Well, right now we're standing in our recreation of Wonderland Park, which was Milwaukee's version, if you will, of Coney Island or Six Flags. At one time, Milwaukee had this great amusement park that had a Ferris wheel, a carousel, roller coaster. It even had a water slide called Shoot the Chutes. It would have been in today's Hubbard Park if it was still around, but unfortunately there's no signs of Wonderland anywhere left. So what we're showing off in here is an ice cream parlor that would have been in Wonderland Park because they would have sold ice cream, and we're featuring Lueck ice cream, which was a major Milwaukee dairy at the time period, and John Lueck came up with two innovations for ice cream that really made Lueck a name in the nation. The first thing he did was came out with a process to freeze ice cream in bricks and put it in take-home cartons, much like a Chinese take-home box today. And the other thing was he came up with a process to make more than the standard strawberry, vanilla, and chocolate flavors. He came up with the idea, why can't we have fruits and nuts and things like that in ice cream? And before that time period, I guess it would mess up the machinery when you tried to add those things. Well, he came up with a way that he could do it, and other ice cream makers from across the nation came to visit him and learn how to do his process. So you can thank John Lueck for all your different chunky monkeys and cookie dough ice cream.
Why do this kind of three-dimensional recreation where you can literally sit on the stools, where people can actually put themselves into the scene?
We believe in the immersion exhibit, so where you can actually walk into it and experience the exhibit. Much like the streets of old Milwaukee were a little bit more than that, that you can walk into the store, you can walk into the location and see what's on display rather than just look through a window and see it that way. We've just left the Wonderland Park and the ice cream fountain, and now we've walked to the neighborhood hardware store. And so we're showing off some of the hardware items that would have been available for people to buy at the time period. And some of the major things in this exhibit are the electrical objects. The United States was going through a massive electrification process at the time period. Everybody wanted electricity. And obviously, if you create a new product like electricity, there's companies that come along and create a demand for electricity. So you create electric toasters, you create electric irons, percolators, egg cookers, pants pressers, you name it, they make it. So we're just showing off some of those products that became available in the 1920s.
What is it about objects like these that help you to bring people into the past, to tell them these stories about what Milwaukee was like at this time period?
It's my opinion that it's through these objects that we can tell the story better because, for instance, showing a toaster, everybody can relate to a toaster. Although ours looks much different than your modern toaster, once we describe how it works, you get the general idea of the principle involved, or the coffee maker, or the electric iron. It's just a way of showing people that this is how history goes, and I think that's a way to do it with three-dimensional objects like this. And we're fortunate that Mr. Chudnow saved a lot of this stuff that probably would have long time ago ended up in the landfill somewhere.
As we're finishing our errands, we've just gone to the hardware store. Where are we now?
Now we've walked into the local neighborhood grocery store, and this is the H. Groffman Grocery Store, which is the other side of the Chudnow family. Mr. Chudnow was married to Anita Groffman, and this was her parents' grocery store at 603 Valete Street. This would have been a place that you would have shopped almost every day. There were ones throughout the city. I think they estimate there were like 260 neighborhood grocers throughout Milwaukee in the 1920s. They all catered to their clientele, so there were German grocers, there were Polish grocers, Italian grocers. We feel that during the Depression, it's probably because of grocers that keeping people on the books. You know, they didn't have credit cards back then, but because they let people buy things and take it home, but just keep it on the book, so to speak, not pay for it, but pay for it hopefully in the future, that they kept a lot of families fed, because if it wasn't for them, a lot of families probably would have gone hungry. So they let them carry their bills for months at a time before they paid it off.
I'm really impressed at the fact that Mr. Chudnow had this vision that he would keep some of these things.
Yeah, I mean, it's incredible that somebody had that kind of vision, and I think we're fortunate there are people like that who seem to recognize, for whatever reason, they seem to recognize that somebody needs to save this stuff, because most of these items in here would have been thrown out long ago. I mean, let's face it, how many of us would have saved an old Quaker Oats carton or a Carnation malted milk box or a Red Star yeast box or whatever? I mean, we would have thrown those out a long time ago, but he saw the need to collect and save these things. He labeled himself a conservator. That's what he called himself. And I think that's probably a pretty apt term for him. I mean, I think he felt like he was conserving this stuff for the future. And I think he really did.
Well, where to next?
Well, the next room we're going to walk into is our transportation exhibit. We've got a recreation of Union Depot, which was the Chicago, Milwaukee, and St. Paul Railway Depot that was sort of in the Menominee Valley area, sort of around Pottawatomie Bingo in that general vicinity. And so we're showcasing transportation and the various changes that happened in the 1920s. The car starts to slowly take over and the train starts a slow decline that doesn't stop until about the 1960s.
Tell us about who we're looking at.
Well, we have a porter, an African-American porter, and what we're showing here is the African-Americans' participation in the Porters Union, the United Brotherhood of Railroad Workers. And this is a big deal for African-Americans because this was a prime job if you were an African-American male. This was a good middle-class job for African-Americans at a time period when a lot of them were basically relegated to basically hard physical labor, and they didn't make a whole lot of money. Whereas an African-American porter, he made about $875 in 1920s money, which at the time period was a little bit below the average worker. I think they made about $1,200, so he wasn't making quite as much, but it was still a significant amount for an African-American worker. And they were looked upon in their neighborhood as being a role model for people. You know, that was a prime job, and they were kind of considered a person who had made it. They had made the American dream.
Who else was living in Milwaukee at this time?
Well, Milwaukee was made up of a lot of different ethnic groups: Germans, Poles, Irish, Italian, Eastern Europeans, Irish. You know, so it was a mixture of people. Germans probably the most numerous at the time period, but at the end of the First World War, Milwaukee started to lose its identity as a German city. Before that time period, German was spoken on the streets. They had German newspapers. They had German plays, operas. After the First World War and during the First World War, a lot of that changed. Obviously, they had to keep a lower profile.
Now let's take a trip to Bayview. We're going to Bayview Drugstore. What do we see here in this room? What is on display here?
Well, what we've recreated in here is a typical pharmacy from the 1920s. Medicine and pharmacy is undergoing a lot of changes in the 20s. Before 1920, there were a lot of patent medicines sold over the counter or through catalogs. And patent medicines were basically concoctions or elixirs that different companies sold to people that cured everything from hiccups to cancer. Honestly, most of them didn't do any of those things. And the three major ingredients that seemed to be in most of these concoctions were cocaine, heroin, and alcohol.
Wow.
So you can imagine that most of the patients who took these things were basically covering up the problem. They weren't really solving anything. And chances are, if you took it long enough, you probably became addicted to the elixir that you would take.
I guess that's one way to get a repeat customer.
Yes, the pharmacies would sell a lot of this stuff, or the catalogs would. But starting in the 1920s, the Food and Drug Administration started clamping down on the patent medicine companies for selling these products, and they started requiring that these ingredients, these three ingredients, would be either taken out, or the quantities or the strength of it would be lessened so that people wouldn't be receiving the doses that they were.
Well, I see that there's a clinic upstairs. Shall we head to that?
Yeah, we can go up to the second floor of the building and you'll get a chance to see the other part of the house. This is the first room at the top of the stairs on the second floor. This was Dr. Joseph Eisenberg's clinic. And so what we're showcasing in here, at one time Dr. Eisenberg owned this building from about the mid-20s to about the mid-1950s, and he was a general practitioner who graduated from Marquette's medical school. We've documented that through some research. He operated it as a home clinic.
It's pretty interesting given where we're located just a couple blocks from Aurora Sinai Hospital.
Yeah, I mean, we're in the neighborhood of a mega hospital, but back in the 1920s, there weren't a lot of those type of institutions. So a lot of these clinics or infirmaries kind of filled in for that when there was a need for people to be able to go somewhere and be taken care of.
Well, this next room is fairly colorful.
Yeah, what we're displaying in here are toys of the time period. So we've got a shop window here. We're calling it Grand Avenue Toys. You can use your imagination. It could have been Gimbel's or Schuster's, one of the big department stores at the time period. But it's showcasing some of the products that were available to the families at that time period. This was the advent of the board game. Families were able to spend more free time at home together playing games. With the eight-hour workday and the ability of mothers and fathers to make better incomes through different kinds of jobs, they didn't have to work long hours, they didn't have to work from sun up to sundown every night. They did have some free time to spend with their kids, and this was a chance for them to sit around the table, play a game, and get to know each other a little bit and find out that maybe dad has a sense of humor and mom's not such a bad person either, and find out what their kids are into. So it's a way to educate our visitors that mass production of games and consumerism, if you will, we're really kind of showing off consumerism here, that this was a way that the American family was kind of evolving in the time period.
Well, right off of the toy store, we have Saks Theater, I guess another place where families would go to get entertainment.
Yeah, the 20s is the advent of the talking picture, the big movie palaces, if you will. And so what we're showing in this room, we've kind of taken the Saks brothers as our model because they owned a lot of the really big movie palaces in town. And so we're just calling this the Saks Theater, kind of a generic name. We show movies of the time period like 1931 Frankenstein at Halloween. We show Shirley Temple movies, For Whom the Bell Tolls, you know, different films of the 20s and 30s.
Well, let me ask you, just how many items does the museum have on display and then also in its possession?
Well, currently on display we have 700 items. We estimate, and this is purely an estimate at this point, that there's over 250,000 items in Mr. Chudnow's collection.
Wow, that's a lot. How do you even begin to go through that and figure out what's worth displaying and what's not?
Yeah, it's a big effort, and my hope is as we go forward, we can make an online museum catalog so people can see what's in the collection, and then we can maybe offer some of these items on loan to other area museums. So it could be a way that we can expand the reach of this museum by showing off some of the great stuff that Mr. Chudnow collected. And then there's a room up on the second floor that I consider a changing exhibit room that I want to put in some new and varied objects so that we can keep making this a fresh experience for people. When visitors come through, they can say, well, I was here 6 months ago, but it's not quite the same as it was when I first walked through.
Steve Daly is the director of the Chudnow Museum of Yesteryear, located right near 11th and Kilbourne in Milwaukee. Tomorrow marks its Founders Day in honor of Avram Michael Chudnow, whose collection comprises the museum. There'll be half-price admission all day from 10 to 4, guest speakers, and a new documentary on Mr. Chudnow in the theater. That is all the time we have today. I'm Bonnie Knorr. Thanks so much for joining us. I hope you can be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next.
That's the Broadway melody.